Namaste and welcome to the Bharat Varta Weekly. I'm Roshan Karyapa. I have with me my friend Nirav Kanodra as well. And we will be running you through some of the news and events of the week that was. Hey Nirav, how are you? How's Singapore?
All good, same old.
So Bangalore has been raining the past few days. I mean, pretty heavily. I think you guys would have seen some photos on Twitter and everything. Thank God I don't have to commute. So we have plenty of things to cover in this weekly. We'll be talking about the looming power crisis, which we've been covering for a couple of weeks now. Talk about the unfortunate Singhu lynching. The country is celebrating Puja and Navratri. Then Prime Minister Modi announced the formation of 7 defense companies on Vijayadashami. We also had the global hunger index that came out, and unfortunately, India has slipped, you know, a few places on that. And in the ever unfolding Punjab politics drama, we have Sidhu back in the Congress now. And finally, to round things off on sports, we have the IPL finals and also Rahul Dravid taking over as India coach. Plenty of news and events to cover. So let's get started. And as usual, we'll talk about the couple of episodes we put out last week. So Nirav, what do you think about the episode on Punjab politics? As always, I mean, Rohit is fairly comprehensive with these things. What do you think?
So I think Rohit, obviously, one is he's like super comprehensive. And he shed lights on things like what goes, what probably is the thought process of like after removing Amrinder, who should be the next CM? Why was Sidhu not made the next PM despite being the most popular person with like national recognition and statewide recognition, etc. Right? There were like other names in the fray like Ambika Soni and whatnot. So I think it's a very insightful episode. I think we will see this drama go along till the next Punjab elections. So it's interesting to see, and definitely let's wait and watch.
Yeah, for sure. No, the way Rohit is able to marry some of these facts and anecdotes with the history and the culture of the region, right, is just phenomenal. I haven't seen anyone do that, really. And we also put out a premium-only episode on Varanasi. This is, of course, in the Itihasa series that Vivek Hetan is doing for us. And this was, again, a very rich and comprehensive insight into Varanasi itself. It's considered widely the holiest place in India. Do check it out. And, of course, subscribe to Bharat Varta on YouTube. The first piece of news, obviously, is the fact that after a long and dreadful 18 months, we had a pleasant change last week. The cases have been, I would say, thereabouts 20,000 or so. India was celebrating, right, after a long time, I feel. And there was a lot of optimism in the air. Of course, Puja and Navratri. Nirav, what do you think?
Oh, as in, like, I think it's a fantastic thing that India is coming back. The festival season has started. People are now vaccinated in large numbers, and so they can go out and celebrate. It's like the symbolism also is quite nice. Yeah. So like there are the two stories which go behind Navratri. So one is Ram, after like 14 years of exile, the 9 days he fights Ravana and kills him on the 10th day, a victory of good over evil. And so it's like as if you've been fighting with COVID and then winning over the disease, probably, if you just say symbolically. Similarly, like Durga defeating Mahishasur after 9 days of fighting, and then on the 10th day, Mahishasur is beheaded as well. So I think it's very nice. Symbolically, it has shown now India is kind of moving out. We've started the festival season. It typically is like Ganesh Chaturthi onwards. Now we've got this, and now soon Diwali will be coming up. So it's a very nice cycle. And hopefully all this festive mood kickstarts people's happiness as well as like the economy. So we've defeated the virus, hopefully, and we've moved ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was great to see that optimism return, you know, and touch wood. I mean, hopefully it persists for longer as well, right? The festive season is here. Folks, stay safe, take care, and of course, get vaccinated and also, you know, celebrate the festival season. I'm really happy that, you know, I mean, all of the small businesses and small entrepreneurs get a chance to like revive some of their fortunes. They've been perhaps very, very badly hit in the last 18 months, right? So that's a positive change. In the festive week on Vijayadashmi, Prime Minister Modi has announced the creation of 7 new state-run defense companies with an eye on making India a global brand in the defense sector. These companies will aim to serve the needs of self-reliance or Atmanirbhar in defense. The companies serve every need of an army, from ammunition to explosives to army vehicles. They will also manufacture advanced weapons, troop comfort items, and a variety of other things. I think, you know, a couple of weeks back, we discussed the Ordnance Factory Board dissolution. Abhishek had, you know, lent a lot of good perspective on that. And the ordnance factories were about 41, including 11 ammunition and explosives, 10 weapons and vehicles, about 20 for material equipment and so on. And in all, I think there were 80,000 people employed in this. You know, it was, again, one of those very tough decisions politically, right? I mean, 80,000 people employed, as you can imagine. And as with the whole Air India privatization, we've seen that, you know, the government is able to marry this political will, even with the large mandate, right? Along with these policy measures that are, you know, difficult but necessary. And, you know, the Ordnance Factory Board itself is a relic from the past, right? I mean, it's been around forever, 100, 200 years old history. And it was basically used for all requisitions from the army. And there was a lot of criticism, as you can imagine. You know, if you have a captive customer and there are no contracts, it's basically, you know, delays and inefficiencies and bureaucracies and all of that stuff. And if you pair this with how the nature of war itself has changed, right? We had General Mikrain, for example, talking about this in one of the Bharat Varta episodes as well. You know, wars are not fought in that conventional 1970s style where the army goes in and the Navy and the Air Force come in at some point, right? I mean, it's not like that. We're seeing fully integrated battle units these days. There's a huge difference between a department of a government, which was what the Ordnance Factory was, and a PSU, right? Now the PSU will have to compete with the likes of a Tata or a Mahindra or Bharat Forge and all the rest of them. And this decade is going to become very important from a defense perspective for India, right? We've already seen the UP and TN defense corridors as well, and the kind of support that they've been getting from everything from water supply and power to financial incentives and so on. The seven companies that the government has announced are Munitions India Limited, Armored Vehicles Nigam Limited, Advanced Weapons and Equipment India Limited, Troop Comforts Limited, Yantra Limited, India Optel, and Gliders India. I think Gliders India will sort of encompass all air vehicles and drones and things to that effect, I feel. So this has been something that has been in the works for a very, very long time. But, you know, I mean, it's glad that it's come to fruition at this point of time. And it's especially important because, you know, India is the second largest importer of arms, right? If you look at the last 5 to 10 years, I think total of 9% of global arms is imported by India. And this, again, doesn't pair with our ambition and aspiration of becoming an Atmanirbhar Bharat, right? So a lot of research and innovation will go into it. And I think it'll have a lot of trickle-down effect as well in terms of startups or SMEs and other kind of companies working in this defense sector, right? And to also show that the government is really serious, there's an order book of around 65,000 crore that has been awarded, right, or announced. So yeah, I mean, this is a much needed move. You know, hopefully a lot of this innovation will, you know, come to bear in the coming 5 to 10 years. Yeah.
Actually, just adding a bit, I think this is a classic case of from like being a government unit to a PSU. This improves the productivity of the whole sector, right? It gets Absolutely. A little more lean. We, instead of buying a lot of things overseas, we can make domestically, builds up our skill sets, generates employment. So I think it's like a positive all around. And very much needed as well.
So the coal shortage that we were speaking about for a few weeks has reached its apex. Power plants all over India have been experiencing shortages, as 3 out of 4 power plants possess less than a week's coal in stock, which is pretty alarming. Power plants are grappling with a surge in demand from industries as India's economy is picking up after the second wave of COVID-19. Power consumption has jumped 17% in just 2 months. Nirav, you know, this has come to a head. What do you see happening? You know, will the government step in to improve the situation? And if so, how?
Yeah, so already the government has done something. So one is that you had like a little bit of late monsoons, unseasonal rains. That's why some mines were shut. So that is one of the reasons. Second, as you mentioned, our power consumption has gone up like to 17%, right? Which is showing our manufacturing sector is picking up, our exports are picking up, which means that now going forward for our manufacturing sector, probably power is a bottleneck. And that has to be recognized. Short-term fixes the government has done is they have allowed like captive coal mines. Like say, for example, Tata Steel has a captive coal mine. A lot of other steel and manufacturing units have one, which they have a captive power plant. They're allowed to sell coal to other power plants. So they've done that step, that at least temporarily there's some respite. They've imported a lot of Australian coal and some from Indonesia as well. So that has happened. What we are seeing right now is a global energy crisis. So you're seeing natural gas production stalled in Europe, in like the North Sea, in Netherlands and UK. After that, you're seeing a power crisis in China. Globally, all data centers are taking up a lot of energy. We are seeing more electric vehicles. One is, how do we tackle it in the immediate run? As I think the temperatures also fall across India, the power demand in residential areas will reduce a bit. So that is a good thing. But longer term, we need to look at options of generating more power. Probably nuclear is one of them. A lot of opposition. It's a very emotional topic where people just have blind opposition. So I think it has to be well managed and well communicated. But it shows that we will need a lot of power. Coal isn't dead yet because India has a lot of coal that allows us to be Atmanirbhar. So maybe we have to use coal. We need more power plants to be set up, right? So I think all of these, we need some sort of a policy in place. Seasonally, winter sees the demand fall off. So we see peak demand in summer, and then we see peak demand at the end of monsoon, where October is still very warm. So hopefully we get sorted out for this year, but for the next year onwards and going forward, we need to think long term.
No, as I've said before, I think my sympathy is with whoever is modeling the demand supply at this point, right? I mean, seriously, what do you even do with these things? Hopefully that crisis is averted. In an unfortunate case, India has fallen from 94 to 101 on the global hunger index. The report offered COVID-19 and related restrictions as the reason for the increased rate of hunger in the country. India is currently behind neighbors Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Nepal. The GHI score is calculated on 4 indicators: undernourishment, child wasting, child stunting, and child mortality. The report states that forces like conflict, climate change, and COVID-19 threaten to wipe out any progress that has been made against hunger in recent years. I think this is pretty interesting. There have been conflicting reports and conflicting statements, right? I think the government has criticized it, so on. We'll get to that. But I do feel that, something has to be taken seriously. Of course, I mean, nobody will flat out say that, there is no poverty or hunger in India. There's no despair in India. That's not true. But at the same time, I think we have to view these reports for what they are, right? And how they have been measured. If we have to actually proactively solve this crisis as well, right? So this report has been put together by Global Hunger Report, Concern Worldwide, and Welt Hunger Hillife. All of them are international organizations. And so India was earlier 94, it slipped to 101. And on the scale itself, I think India is at 27.5, which ranks as serious. There are 31 other countries of that sort. And as you've seen, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Pakistan, even Myanmar is ranked better than India. And I think if you look at the 3 parameters that they have, right, I think what we're really suffering on is the child wasting and child stunting. Wasting is basically the corresponding weight for the particular height, and stunting is the age, the height for the specific age, right? And if you look at child mortality, for instance, we've done remarkably well, right? The number of deaths under 5 years in India has dropped from something like 3.4 million in 1990 to around 800,000 in 2019, right? So infant mortality has reduced as well in that same time. So if you look at, wasting, stunting, and nourishment, right? I mean, I think we also have to look at the proper definitions of these, right? Because nourishment, what the organization says is, one of the things is that you need to get 1,800 calories. Now, 1,800 calories, as we all know, is a sizable amount. Even so, I think the traditional Indian diet, lacks some of the macronutrients like proteins and fats, which again, are key to growth, right? The government has sort of criticized this, saying that, there was a 4-question opinion poll that was run by Gallup on telephone. And that's not a scientific approach. But then the organizations have basically responded saying, no, it was conducted in a different manner. And what you're seeing is also an impact of COVID, right? But even so, I think if you look at welfare in India, right? I mean, we were able to get food and supplies and rations to all far corners of the country, even during these desperate times, which very advanced economies like the US and Europe struggled to do so. This is definitely something that we should look at and something that we should introspect on. But at the same time, I think we also have to keep in mind the classic case of Wittgenstein ruler, right? Where if you're using a ruler to measure the table, and if your ruler is not reliable, you might actually be using the table to measure the ruler instead.
So here, one of the things due to COVID is schools have been shut.
Exactly.
All government schools had the midday meal scheme. I think that was quite a good thing. Hopefully, with vaccination starting for younger kids as well, schools even primary schools and like kindergarten, etc. starts, the midday meal goes a long way. So apart from the fact that maybe the poll is flawed, maybe our rank shouldn't be 94, maybe it should be 74, etc. As you mentioned, I think there are definite steps that we need to take. And just by reopening schools and restarting the midday meal goes a long way in ensuring that kids get some basic amount of nutrition.
Yeah. No, we did an episode on Akshay Patra, actually. A few, you know, I think Mr. Sridhar Venkat, the CEO of the program, was on the podcast, and he spoke at length about all the problems that we're facing and how we're solving this last mile challenge, right? And that's a very comprehensive, very interesting outlook on this. Do have a look at it. I think on that front, you know, the way governments, various governments, not just the center, I think the state governments have cooperated is something admirable, really, you know, because we often, you know, doubt the government capacity, intent, all of those things, right? But on that one front, I think people have been united, and that's something positive for sure, right? We had the unfortunate case of a man being brutally lynched and strung up at Singhu in Haryana, and this was at a farmer's protest site. Nihang Sikhs, who are part of the protest, claimed responsibility for the lynching on the grounds that the victim allegedly disrespected the Sikh holy book. Two Nihang Sikhs surrendered to the police in connection to this case. The Sikhs were persuaded to hand the accused over, with the Samyukt Kisan Morcha intervening to make sure the matter didn't get out of hand. Police said a preliminary postmortem had shown 37 injuries on Lakbir, who is the alleged victim, right? So, Nirav, you know, already tensions are kind of running high around these farm reforms and stuff. What do you see the impact of something like this?
So I think maybe this is the moment where probably the sentiment against the farmer flips a bit. So there's a lot of background here. So one is, I only after like watching this Punjab politics episode and like following this farmer's protest, have realized the internal caste system within the Sikhs, which I thought was like caste free. But so Nihang Sikhs are the more like the warrior ones, Jat Sikhs are the farmers. And a lot of the protests are being done by the elite rich, large plot owning Sikh farmers who are the beneficiaries of all government policies like MSP, etc., and who are cornering the market and getting a lot of subsidies. Whereas like a lot of poor farmers are usually laborers on these big farmers' plots. Now, this Lakhvir case here is a very unfortunate one, but there's also a caste backstory that he is a Dalit who probably, so I don't know the facts, but who by touching the Guru Granth Sahib desecrated it. And that's why the anger has come out and he's been unfortunately killed and his hands chopped off. So what this shows is like a background of caste violence, which would flip the sentiment of all the other people. You are seeing that the farm laws, I personally believe they are like a big step forward. They help broad range of farmers, except the small elites who were, or the money lenders, arathyas and the agents who were getting bulk of the subsidies, right? So it's spreading it all around. And this might actually flip public sentiment against them. It's too soon to say. Also, you can see the rising frustration amongst the protesters that after protesting for about a year, they haven't really achieved what they wanted, which was rollback of these three farm laws. It's a bit of a stalemate. It is stuck and no one is budging on either side. And when such things happen, when people are very tensed, there's no excuse for it, but these stupid errors happen. And this can like totally change the storyline. And so it's very unfortunate. Thankfully, the people who have put their hands up and they've kind of surrendered themselves to the police. Hopefully this court case gets resolved as soon as possible and the judges give the appropriate punishment. But there is no real excuse for beheading someone. And once this kind of thing happens, the public sentiment turns usually on a dime. And maybe if that happens, it'll be good that these protests stop. Everybody goes back to their own business. Farmers go back to farming instead of camping outside a highway. And we all move ahead. Maybe if the farm laws resolution, anything has to happen, can happen on a table, face to face with the government. But this is absolutely not the way to behave. So let's see.
No, it's pretty unfortunate, and I agree with you, right? I think the small section of farmers who are, you know, very vocal about the opposition have kind of overplayed their hand, right? Actually, I mean, starting with the whole Republic Day fracas that we saw up to now, right? I mean, there's simply no excuse for everything that has happened. And really, I think, you know, India has a lot of sentiment for farmers, right? Jai Jawan, Jai Kisan. I think the way forward is for the large farmers who will actually benefit from the farm laws to come forward and really make the case for why, you know, these laws have to be brought up, right? And really overshadow this vocal minority that are trying to hold the government at siege. And it's reaching a point where this is becoming an internal security threat as well, right? I mean, so I really hope that the Home Minister and the government take necessary action on this count, right? So after a meeting with Rahul Gandhi, Navjot Singh Sidhu has reported that he would continue as head of Punjab Congress. So Sidhu has stated that he had withdrawn his resignation after concerns with the party had been resolved. As per reports, he was not happy with the appointment of the new Punjab police chief and the advocate general, besides some portfolio allocations to ministers after the new cabinet formation. The Congress now hopes that with all this drama behind, a unified front of Navjot Singh Sidhu and Charanjit Singh Channi would be able to help the party's chances in the upcoming assembly polls. Well, we discussed some of this at length in the episode on Punjab politics with Rohit Jayaraman. And Sidhu is a very interesting character, right? I mean, he's the joker in the pack. Formerly, he was with the BJP, then flipped to the Congress, then supposedly resigned, and now he's back, right? I mean, this is a lot of flip-flops in a very short period of time. He does have some local support. He has significant local support, but there is also some resentment because, I mean, he was, you know, earlier seen hugging General Bajwa in Pakistan, right, off Pakistan. And there are two or three schools of thought on, you know, whether Rahul and Priyanka were actually played by Sidhu or, you know, Sidhu was played by Rahul and Priyanka, right? And Rohit seems to think that, you know, I mean, Rahul Gandhi basically used Navjot Sidhu to depose Amrinder, right? And that was a very smart ploy. But what they didn't expect was for Sidhu to actually, you know, not play along and resign. So it seems like, you know, that has been sorted out. And in all of this, I think, there's a lot to gain for the other parties who are, trying to come off as a viable alternate to, you know, the fractured Congress or the unpopular Akalis, right? These would be AAP and BJP, basically. AAP has a problem of not having a chief minister face at this point of time, right? And again, Rohit had a very interesting point that, you know, Punjab is a larger state, so Kejriwal is probably holding on to little more closely than otherwise, right? So that and BJP, although, I mean, definitely not popular in the state, given everything that's happened on the farm laws and everything, while that may be the case, they may actually come up as, key alliance partners, right? I mean, those six or seven seats that they may potentially win could make a difference. So the polls are supposed to be in February or March of next year, and there's significant time. There's five more months left. So we don't know if this is the last of the flip-flops and, how things will pan out from here on. But one should say, I mean, it's pretty interesting, everything that's happening around this. And this is also very, very important for the Congress to win this, right? I mean, it's the last, one of the last standing states that they have in their control. And a lot at stake, I would say. And finally, to round things off, CSK have won the IPL again for the fourth time, beating KKR by 27 runs in the final. From 91 to no loss in the 11th over, KKR slumped to 125 for 8 in the 17th over in a dramatic batting collapse. KKR were reeling at the 7th spot at the end of the India leg with just 2 wins from 7 matches. They stormed into the final, winning the eliminator against RCB Bangalore and qualifier 2 against table toppers Delhi Capitals. Nirav, an exciting period of 2020 cricket comes to an end, and another begins, I suppose, with the World Cup.
Yeah, so I think this leg of the IPL, you saw a lot of turnaround. I think CSK were table toppers till they had like a few matches they lost on the trot. So The whole second leg, I think it was a great tournament. It was lovely to see crowds in the stadiums. So that was fantastic as well. And you saw a lot of competitive matches and a lot of upsets. So instead of having one favorite which goes on and wins through and through, that nature of unpredictability in a short span makes like T20 cricket more interesting versus like test match cricket, though it's like the real test. Usually the better team usually wins. Here the better team on the day wins, and that kind of uncertainty keeps fans interested. So this was a great tournament. Dhoni has been there in the team right since inception in 2008. So 14 seasons. He's probably not retired yet. So that's fantastic. Another good thing is that the T20 World Cup is also going to be held in the UAE in the same three stadiums. So all the Indian players in the squad have been better acclimatized versus only a few players from like different countries, right? Maybe it gives India an edge. So that's a fantastic thing. In like other news, though the appointment is after the World T20, Rahul Dravid has been appointed as the head coach. And Paras Mambre is the bowling coach. And that's also a fantastic thing. I think Virat Kohli will be stepping down as a T20 captain. Ravi Shastri will be stepping down as coach. I do believe personally that captaincy and coaches, they have like a certain period or like not exactly shelf life, but there are like phases where one set of ideas works very well. And then sometimes you need to find different set of ideas because the game keeps evolving, opposition keeps evolving, etc. Dravid was the India under-19 coach. And once we were runners-up and then once we were the winners. So he knows the next crop of players really well. And he and Paras Mambre were both involved in the National Cricket Academy in Bangalore. So where a lot of the budding cricketers have been training or the ones who are injured are recuperating. So I think that's a fantastic thing that they know a lot of grassroots players. India has shown in all the series previously, we've got a great bench strength. So having a coach who knows the next rung quite well is always great so that we have the best set of crop of players coming up. So all in all, I think it's a positive. I am a Mumbai supporter, unhappy that they didn't reach the playoffs. But fine, CSK won.
Hey, you're talking to an RCB guy here. For God's sakes. Come on.
Anyway, well done, CSK. Great. So good that they won. Hope India does well at the World T20 as well.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by people who can find inspiration after having achieved all of this greatness, right? I mean, really, what is there for Dhoni left to achieve, you know? The guy is 40 years old and still he's pushing himself. If you see him on the field, I mean, he's probably more alert and more enthusiastic than some of the younger ones, right? I mean, it's pretty insane, actually. And you hit the nail on the head with Dravid, right? I mean, the guy has been under-19 captain. He has a lot of continuing context on how the team has evolved, how these players have come up. And I think, you know, potentially, you know, a very, very good replacement for Ravi Shastri. So yeah, I mean, exciting times ahead, and let's see how the T20 World Cup pans out. All right, folks. So that's a wrap from us here. Before we leave, we have a couple of interesting episodes. Of course, I mean, we've been saying that we'll put the India-US relations episode out for a couple of weeks, but unfortunately, I mean, due to some scheduling conflicts, it has been delayed for a fair bit now. But hopefully, fingers crossed, I mean, we should be able to put this episode out this week. And, you know, we did an episode earlier, I think in February or March of this year, where we had looked at the Biden administration and how things will pan out. Whether it will be an Obama 3.0 or whether there will be some surprises. Obviously, I mean, things have, things have thrown up a few surprises. We'll be discussing that in further detail with Sunandaji and Srimoyin Talukdar, right? Very interesting people. And last week, we had a big one. We had a conversation with Mr. Vikram Sood, who is, the foremost intelligence authority, in India. And this was part of the Velina's Talk series, which is hosted by Velina Chakarova. And that should be out on Tuesday. And will be a very, very good episode to look forward to. So stay tuned and follow us on all social media. And, there's a lot of interesting, exciting content coming up. Please share and subscribe. And from Nirav and myself, thank you so much again for joining us. Stay safe, take care, and Jai Hind.